we're looking literally at every avenue possible in city government to find savings to make the cuts necessary to balance the budget.
Anchorage faces a $30 million budget shortfall. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 21st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the last Cold War radar towers in Alaska may be coming down.
They're an important era in our history, not just of our community, but of our world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan says the city is facing a $30 million budget gap. Speaking to the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce yesterday, Sullivan says that is the amount needed if the city expects to have the same size of government next year.
The $30 million gap is probably a fairly accurate figure. And so we're looking literally at every avenue possible in city government to find savings to make the cuts necessary to balance the budget, because we have no choice. Our budget has to balance.
The mayor says more than half of the $30 million is due to increased labor costs. The mayor says the city also expects to pay $4.5 million more this year into the police and fire pension fund. Sullivan says there will be major expense cuts. He says it is hard to say at this point what could occur as far as city layoffs.
When you talk about a $30 million deficit, you know, no one department can shoulder that. It means police, it means fire, it means libraries, it means transit, it means parks. It means virtually every department of the city has to participate in order to balance the budget.
The administration is expected to present its 2013 financial plan to city assembly members by October 1st. The city operating budget for 2012 is $454.6 million. There is political chatter in Washington, D.C. that Congress may alter its self-imposed ban on earmarks in January. Earmarks are the local pet projects of lawmakers that the federal government pays for. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, it's unlikely that lawmakers will revert back to the large allocations seen in the earlier part of this century.
Let's take a step back and remember just how Congress got to the point of banning earmarks, one of the hallmarks of holding elected federal office. Professor Alan Schick from the University of Maryland is an expert on the federal budgeting process.
From the very beginning of American history through close to the middle of the 20th century, appropriations were highly itemized for specific projects, specific activities, specific items that a government agency was going to spend money on.
Then the government started its rapid expansion, and line items, the specific projects the government funds, grew into broader categories. That, Professor Schick says, gave more power to the executive branch. Because this is a jump back to civics class, Congress authorizes the money for the agencies the president oversees.
The broader the appropriation, the more control the executive branch has over spending. Congress has responded to this by, in recent decades, significantly increasing the volume of earmarks.
Those earmarks paid for all sorts of projects, from landing strips at airports to rural health centers to attempts to build a bridge to Gravina. That last one was lampooned nationally as the Bridge to Nowhere. It's just one of countless projects watchdogs and many lawmakers deemed wasteful. So, with reluctance, last year, Congress opted to temporarily ban earmarks. It's had some effect. Giant, multi-year pieces of legislation, like the farm and highway bills, have stalled or taken longer than normal to pass. That's in part because of the political climate, but it's also because lawmakers cannot trade a yes vote for federal funding for back home, as Senator Ben Nelson learned when he was chided for the so-called Cornhusker kickback. That agreement would have helped pay for Nebraska's Medicaid tab in exchange for a yes vote for the health care bill. The provision was ultimately removed. The transportation bill that recently passed included more than $30 million for the Alaska Railroad. The Senate version zeroed out funding. A Senate committee said the railroad did not qualify for the earmark it had historically received because the money was allocated for public transportation. But the final product had the money restored because Representative Don Young served on the committee that melded the House and Senate versions of the bill. And that giant bill does not mention the Alaska Railroad. Steve Ellis, with Taxpayers for Common Sense, says Congressman Young manipulated the bill's language to include the funding.
You write it such that you set up the criteria as to what, how to get the funding, and the only place that matches that criteria is the Alaska Railroad.
Ellis says this is an example of members of Congress flouting the earmark ban, a ban that some lawmakers say is going to be removed come January. Congressman Young, a vocal supporter of the earmarking process, is one of the legislators who believes the ban will be altered, though it will not be easy to do. There still is considerable opposition to spending from deficit hawks in his own Republican Party, especially from the 87 freshmen in this year's class, and for the potential new members come January, who are now running on fiscally tight platforms.
There's going to be a big fight if they, those that oppose it, because it's not going to be for any individual company or anything like that. It'll be for municipalities, nonprofit organizations.
That idea that nonprofits could qualify for earmarks has government watchdogs up in arms. Steve Ellis says the plan has been tested before.
I guarantee you the Cowgirl Hall of Fame, which was an earmark, was a nonprofit. The Teapot Museum was a nonprofit.
Of course, not all nonprofits would look for federal help. Still, many in Washington worry that political groups disguised as social welfare organizations would reap extra benefits from the new earmark rules. Some, like Crossroads GPS and MoveOn.org, are spending millions of dollars in this year's election, even though they are supposed to promote the public good. If the chatter moves to action, Congressman Young is right. There will be an enormous political fight. By law, Congress needs to shrink federal budgets. And one thing remains certain. Even without earmarks, Alaska will continue to get loads of money from Washington. The Census Bureau reports that the federal government spends more per capita in Alaska than any other state. And much of that money comes from the Pentagon, the largest budget in the government, and the one many lawmakers are afraid to cut. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
National Weather Service forecasters say more rain is on the way to northwest Alaska. Downpours there over the past week have led to flooding in Kivalina, Ambler, and other communities, despite a short break in the weather yesterday. Stan Hawley is a tribal administrator and a Kivalina City Council member.
We had one day, brief period of sunshine yesterday, and people were out, kids were out enjoying the sunshine. And then we got up this morning again, and it's all raining again, and blah.
The area received 9 inches of rain in a week, and more is expected. High water muddied the Woolock River near Kivalina and prevented community residents from filling water tanks. The school there is closed indefinitely, Holly says, because of the lack of drinking water. He says some school children are being flown out of the village for classes.
Right now, some parents who can send their kids to nearby villages to school are sending their kids out. I had to send all of mine to Kotzebue, and I'm not too happy about having to do that.
Rainwater also flooded the landfill and washed waste into the Kivalina Lagoon. A state assessment team will fly to Kivalina tomorrow.
The city of Kivalina declared a disaster, and the state is going to have to fly in and see if that the damage threshold meets their definition of a disaster.
Holly says it's expected that the river water will be too muddy for drinking for a couple of weeks. In Ambler, a bridge that provides access to subsistence hunting areas could wash away. Extremely high water on the Kobuk River has partially submerged 4 unopened shipping containers in Kiana. Planes ferrying workers to and from the Red Dog mine were delayed for 5 days last week as more than half the area's annual rainfall fell at the mine. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, creative uses for wind power.
We're putting a 10,000 square foot indoor growing facility for growing lettuce, and our aim is to satisfy about 5% of the lettuce market in Fairbanks.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation.
State attorneys today filed a challenge to the Federal Voting Rights Act in district court in Washington, D.C. The suit stems from legal action in June when some Alaska Native groups sued the Division of Elections for going forward with election plans before the federal government had given the go-ahead to Alaska's 2012 redistricting plan. State Assistant Attorney General Margaret Payton Walsh says the state is only suing against Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act.
We were very concerned that we were not going to be able to hold the primary on time. And because we don't have a permanent redistricting plan and the board is going to have to try again, we wanted to avoid a repetition of that whole experience in 2014. And we don't believe that the requirement, the preclearance requirement of Section 5 is necessary in Alaska. We don't believe it's constitutionally justified. And we think that it creates a specific set of problems that led to that sort of crisis moment in June when we were afraid we weren't going to be able to send out advance absentee ballots.
The June lawsuit against the Division of Elections became moot when the Federal Department of Justice approved Alaska's redistricting plan, but Peyton Walsh says the state is taking the arguments it planned to make in that case to court to exempt Alaska from the restrictions of Section 5.
And that section requires that the states and the jurisdictions that are covered by it, it's not every state in the union, but the states that are covered have to go to the federal government in Washington, D.C. every time they want to make any change in their election laws or procedures. And that could be anything from our new redistricting plan down to moving a polling station across the street. So in order to do anything like that related to elections, we have to go to Washington, D.C. and ask the federal government for permission to do that.
Peyton Walsh says the state suit also challenges the formula that requires certain states to comply with Section 5. Only 11 states must fully comply with Section 5 requirements, although the Voting Rights Act applies to all states. In next Tuesday's primary, Senator Betty Davis faces a challenger. Davis is best known for her support of the Denali Kid Care Program, a state program that provides health insurance for children. She has served East Anchorage for more than a decade. Now she's being challenged in Senate District M by fellow Democrat and former state representative Harry Crawford, who is campaigning hard. But Davis says she won't give up her seat without a fight. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Senator Betty Davis became the first African-American to be elected to the Alaska Senate in 2000. Before that, the Democrat served three terms in the House of Representatives. A former social worker, Davis's priorities have been children, education, health, and social issues. Davis recently traded out 70% of her old East Anchorage district for other communities farther east.
I've talked to a lot of people. I've sent out materials. I've been visiting in my new district, which is Eagle River.
Davis's District M was just reorganized by redistricting. During that process, she lost a stronghold, Airport Heights, and gained neighborhoods as far out as Eagle River. She says she suspects manipulation in the redistricting.
They did that strictly to try to make that a district that could be won by a Republican. I'm a part of the Senate Majority Caucus, and the governor's openly come out saying he's trying to dismantle that because he doesn't want that to exist. And the lines have been drawn to really give advantage to the people that are serving in Eagle River.
Davis grew up in Louisiana. She came to Alaska about 40 years ago with her husband, who was in the military. She ran for the Anchorage School Board, beating out about two dozen competitors, and eventually became chair. Then a House seat opened up in Juneau. She ran, and she won. Along the way, she served on the State Board of Education and on boards of several women's organizations. Of her competitor, fellow Democrat Harry Crawford, who she says she supported as a representative in her district, Davis says she was surprised he challenged her.
She came to me and asked me if I would withdraw from the race, and I told him I would not. He is my rep on one side of my district here, and I've done everything that I could to support him. I was surprised that another Democrat, it didn't show a whole lot of respect as far as I'm concerned for him to come out and say, oh, well, I think I'm the best candidate, so I filed at the last minute to run for that seat. I still refuse to withdraw, and so here we are in a primary.
On the issue of forward funding for the Anchorage School District, Davis is in favor of it.
I've been pushing for that for years. We never really have forwarded, but we have early funded. About 2 years ago, we had a three-year window where we had that for 3 years. And it works very well because you get to get the money to the school district or let them know what they're going to get in a timely manner so they don't have to go through the process of pink-slipping their teachers because they don't know the amount of money they're going to have.
And she says she supports increasing the base student allocation, the amount of money allotted per student to the school district. On lowering taxes for oil companies, Davis says,
we might need to lower it, but that's not determined that it is. And if you look at what's happening on the North Slope at this point, we have more people working there than ever at the present time. Our economy is not in a bad shape, but that's not to say that we don't need to at least talk and explore what we can do. I have nothing against the oil companies. I know that 90% of our monies for our budget come from energy, and quite naturally, I want to do whatever I can to keep that.
On affordable housing, Davis says she wants to help, but wasn't specific about how. As far as health care, Davis says the governor should have accepted the initial funding to set up the health care exchange required by the Affordable Care Act.
There will be an exchange set up. It might have federal money in it, but we still will have to put money in it also. So it's not like they're going to set it up and run it in its entirety. We will have to be participating in that. And so I think that's a grave mistake that we made by not accepting the money.
On the topic of anticipated growth and increasing diversity, Davis says it's important to ensure that every child in the Anchorage School District gets a high-quality education. And equally important, she says, is that there be room for them to become leaders in, say, the legislature.
Of the legislature now, there are 60 members. There is only 12 women out of the 60 that serves in the legislature. There's Native people. There, I guess there's 8 or 9 of them, House and Senate combined, and myself. There are no other minorities represented at that level. I think any government organization should represent the people that it has in its constituents. And that's, you know, something that we're working on.
Whether Davis will continue as senator for District M will be determined in the primary election on August 28th. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Tomorrow evening, we'll hear from Davis's challenger, Harry Crawford. Thirty-one White Alice stations were developed in Alaska during the Cold War. The Anvil Mountain Towers north of Nome are the only White Alice towers still standing in the state. And just last week, the Air Force received directives from the Native Corporation that will take ownership of the land to remove the towers. Those towers, to some, represent a portion of not just Nome's history, but the world's. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has more.
The Air Force and the Army Corps of Engineers are in the process of cleaning up the formerly used defense sites throughout Alaska as part of a large remediation project. When the Air Force announced in the late 90s that the White Alice Towers north of Nome were to be taken down, it was met with large public outcry. The towers were built in 1956 and have served as a historical reminder of the World War and as a local landmark. John Handeland is chair of the Nome Museum and Library Commission.
You know, there are many of these White Alice sites that were in place around Alaska, but the four towers here in Nome are all that remain. And they're an important era in our history, not just of our community, but of our world.
The Sitnisok Native Corporation, the for-profit Native corporation in Nome, is slated to take ownership of the former White Alice site. The Air Force, understanding a land agreement was in the works, removed asbestos-laden panels this summer, leaving the skeletons of the towers for the city of Nome to work with. But negotiations between the city of Nome and Sitnisok started 2 years ago, first with a land trade agreement, and recently, a land lease agreement. After 2 years without an agreement, the Sitnisok Board of Directors voted last Tuesday to take the towers down. The Native Corporation, again, is to take ownership of the 11-acre site through the Alaska Land Transfer Acceleration Act. Board President Chuck Fagerstrom says the board believes the land will be a valuable site for telecommunications.
The Board of Directors did not wish to obligate future Board of Directors and shareholders to any risk of personal injury lawsuits or financial liabilities.
And John Handeland with the Nome Museum and Library Commission says he remains optimistic Sitnisok will allow the city to enter discussion and hopes the vote can be reversed.
Together, in continuing spirit of cooperation, I'm confident that a creative solution can be developed to ensure that Sitnisok's concerns and interests are addressed, and yet the towers can remain for the people of Nome and as well as the visitors to our community.
However, looking at the land as a potential telecommunications site, Fagerstrom says taking down the towers is in the best interest of Sitnisok shareholders. Fagerstrom says the Sitnisok Native Corporation has been in communication with the Air Force.
Shortly after the vote was taken, we communicated with their representative. He was in town, and we informed him of that vote.
Steve Hunt is the remedial project manager for the Anvil Mountain site and throughout the state of Alaska. Phone calls and emails had not been returned regarding their plan for the towers. The Air Force had planned on completing their remediation efforts at the Anvil Mountain site next month. 31 such White Alice sites were established during the Cold War, and by the 1970s, most of the system was deactivated. The technology was replaced by satellite communication. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
Longtime Ketchikan resident and former public official Jack Shea was sentenced yesterday for multiple counts of possessing child pornography. Referring to the former city and borough mayor as a monster loose in the community, Superior Court Judge William Carey issued a sentence of 35 years in prison with 17 to serve, marking the end of a high-profile child pornography case. The investigation started last year on November 4th when Shea took a computer and printer to a local business for repairs. The business discovered images of child pornography and contacted police. Police got a search warrant for Shea's home and seized significantly more images. The 81-year-old Shea was eventually charged with 91 counts of child pornography. The plea deal dropped most of those charges in exchange for a guilty plea to 7 counts. Alaska statutes allow sentences to be reduced by 1/3 for good behavior. With 17 years to serve, Shea could be eligible for parole in about 12 years. He would be 93. However, the judge, defense, and prosecution agreed it's likely that Shea will die in prison. A year and a half after Golden Valley Electric Association turned down his proposal to sell GVEA up to 24 megawatts of power, Fairbanks entrepreneur Mike Kraft is pushing ahead on construction of a second big wind generator at his wind farm near Delta Junction. Kraft says he intends to continue selling the utility 1 megawatt and use the rest of the electricity for a big greenhouse he plans to build next summer. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Mike Kraft's business card says he's the managing partner of Alaska Environmental Power, but last week his title was crew chief and operator of a big tracked excavator that he was using to move a bundle of thick steel reinforcement bars into a big square hole that was lined with a cage of welded rebar. Kraft took a break during a breezy afternoon last week to talk about his latest project at the Delta Wind Farm, a 320-acre parcel located on a ridge just east of Delta.
This foundation is 42 by 42. It's about 5 feet thick, and it has 350 cubic yards of concrete in it. It has 36,000 pounds of rebar. It's all one-inch steel rebar.
Kraft and his crew are erecting a 250-foot tower for a new 900-kilowatt wind generator near two other big turbines, which generate up to 1 megawatt of electricity that he sells to GVEA. That's enough to power about 500 average U.S. homes. He says the new big wind generator that he's putting in now will enable his company to meet the requirements of an experimental power sales agreement with the utility.
They developed this 2 megawatt power sales agreement under experimental premise, wanting to see if we were going to fry the lines and cause brownouts and cause problems for folks that are near the wind farm on this distribution line that we're on. And so we would have proven to them that that's not going to happen.
Kraft says he thinks it's unlikely that GVEA will buy any more of his wind-generated electricity anytime soon, now that the utility has set out to build its $90 million facility at Eva Creek. So he's now working on other plans for his wind farm and the electricity generated there.
What we're thinking is to go ahead and start consuming some of this power in-house, on-site, and the first thing we're going to be doing is we're putting a 10,000-square-foot indoor growing facility for growing lettuce. And our aim is to satisfy about 5% of the lettuce market in Fairbanks.
That's the first of several possible enterprises Kraft says he has in mind for his property.
We've thought about some other projects, like, for example, a water bottling plant is in the discussion. We've also discussed an ice plant.
Kraft says he still believes that wind power is part of an overall strategy that will help wean the industrialized world from its dependence on fossil fuels such as oil and coal. He says just one of his 900-kilowatt turbines can generate enough electricity to displace the use of up to 1,400 gallons of diesel daily. And at $4 a gallon, that potentially could save ratepayers some $5,600 a day. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Tim Ellis in Delta Junction. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers competitive interest rates with programs tailored for first-time homebuyers and home choice seminars that cover the details of purchasing and financing a home. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2012 PFD application with MyPFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Friday, August 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.